This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 15th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 79th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're torn of jean, converse of foot, artfully scruffed of hair and independent of spirit. We're celebrating the indie way of life as we take a look at record retailers' annual Saving Grace Record Store Day.
For a long time, you know, talk to anyone in the media and they'd say, oh, now that the record shop's dead and, you know, physical media's finished. And, you know, it blatantly isn't.
While we're on that musical tip, we'll dip a toe into the burgeoning scene for gig posters. In a world where the physical in music is being usurped by the digital, artists who love bands are fighting back.
My discussion was about how that scene that is a very American scene, the poster art scene, is coming out into the UK, Europe, Brazil, Japan. These places are seeing that resurgence happen too.
And we'll tuck our shirt in, but just a bit, to welcome Broadcast Magazine's Peter White to talk us through the formats, glittery game shows and hot dramas that have just been rocking the annual Cannes TV marketplace.
There was a sort of example of quite a few interesting French dramas being made, and equally Israel remains as hot as a country can be of that size of television market.
All that plus, while we're more eyes than ears, we'll learn what was making the running and earning the ovations at the Istanbul Film Festival. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. All right, let's get things kicked off with one of the records being given a bit of extra love and special treatment for Record Store Day. This is a 10-inch single from Bombino, Niger's Tuareg guitar hero, and this is Azamane Tiliade. That was Azamane Tiliade by Bombino, specially reissued for Record Store Day on 10-inch vinyl. And that track was produced by Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys, which might account for some of that controlled rawness. So, as promised today, we're celebrating Record Store Day, the annual occasion on which music retailers, especially those at the smaller independent specialist end of the spectrum, join hands and sing from the same setlist. Dreamed up in 2007 as a way of boosting interest and support for music retailers, the special day has gained in size and momentum like a thundering vinyl snowball, with major names getting behind it, one-off tracks being recorded to honour it, and luxurious reissuings on vinyl of classic tracks repressed in limited numbers. Oh yeah, and in-store gigs and all that malarkey. This year's event kicks off on Saturday, and to shed some light, I'm here with one of the head honchos of Record Store Day, Spencer Hickman. So what's the big deal about Record Store Day, Spencer?
It's just cool. I mean, it's just nice to see independent businesses working together, especially record stores, because for years everyone was like, oh, these guys don't like these guys, and there's such rivalries now. You know, if you go to Leeds, you've got Crash and Jumbo who co-host a party after they close, and it kind of sounds corny, but it's, you know, it has brought that community together.
I thought you were going to use the phrase one love.
No,
I've used that phrase.
I wouldn't go
but
there.
But I'm not putting those words in your mouth. No. I'm just saying it. Spencer's blushing at the very phrase, one love. And obviously lots of stores put on gigs in store. Obviously they give out records. Special vinyl pressings are done for Record Store Day as well, aren't they? The gigs in store are always cool. You mentioned Rough Trade East. One of the big selling points for that is the in-store gigs that it's become famous for. Is this kind of more of a record store's job now to put on music as well as sell it?
I think that if you're going to go to a physical store and you're going to go shopping to buy physical, you want it to be interesting. And I think also it needs to be interesting as well, because you can go into a record store and there can just be a bunch of records there, but it's not necessarily inspiring, where, you know, you've got all these stores that are popping up, like Pie and Vinyl, who sell traditional pies and have a record shop. You know, Adrian Young in the States owns a record shop that is a hairdresser's stroke record store. So you've got these things that kind of are changing the perception of what a store can be. And I think that's the way that it's got to move forward.
It's having the records, it's displaying them nicely, it's having what you might call a curated selection of stuff, a personal selection of stuff that is clearly maybe not the stuff that you're going to get in the Virgin in Union Square, right, in New York. It's doing that stuff, but also having some other little weird, interesting sideline.
I think that's why Rough Trade worked and works, continue to defy kind of all expectation. I think the really interesting thing with Record Store Day is that as it's grown and as it's got bigger, every year stores are kind of reporting record takings. You know, they take more on that day than they do the whole of December. So I think it's really made them think, oh, there are people out there that really love us and still value us. And I think it's kind of made them think about what they do all year round. So, you know, more stores are doing in stores. I mean, Rise have just opened a vintage clothing store upstairs. So I think it's making people think a little bit about what they're doing. But also it's got them excited again, which is, you know, great. Because for a long time, you know, talk to anyone in the media and they'd say, oh, now that the record shop's dead and, you know, physical media's finished. And, you know, it blatantly isn't.
Which is good news, which is something that we kind of shout from the rooftops on this show and on this station as well. Now, Jack White's the ambassador for Record Store Day this year. What does that sort of mean? I mean, obviously, it's great to attach such a big name to it and someone obviously that's famous, presumably having a fairly decent vinyl collection himself. But what does that kind of mean? What will he be doing? How does that work?
Well, I think really the ambassador is just a stamp of approval. And someone like Jack White, who creates the most insane vinyl and just has crazy ideas and runs with them, and is, you know, world famous, is just fantastic.
It's nice to have an icon up there.
And also he's really known for his vinyl. I mean, Third Man, you know, The Vault, all of that stuff. You know, I've got that. Plus that 12-inch, that's a 10-inch, that's a 7-inch, and, you know, he puts records in balloons. I mean, you know, he's pretty...
You need someone like that,
aren't
there? And maybe you can tell us, before we finish, a few of the sort of key releases, maybe personally or maybe that Record Store Day itself is very excited about, that are coming out this year. As we said, to begin with, there's obviously special pressings and one-off tracks recorded for the day.
There's so many. There's 500 releases this year. And, you know, they do span all genres, which is, that's really exciting for me. So, there's a ton of, like, metal this year, which we've never really had before. So Earache are releasing the world's shortest album, which is 83 seconds long.
Excellent.
Which is pretty cool. And, I mean, the thing that I really want, even though I own it, this is where you become, this is where you know that you're a sad geek, is that I'm going to try and get Juice WRLD Mary Chain Psycho Candy on splatter vinyl, just because it looks amazing.
Now, are you in? I presume you're in the position to be able to get one of the first pressings of that, but I don't want to
cast
any aspersions
on the
distribution system of Record Store Day.
I don't get any favours whatsoever.
So you're going to have to be done select a disc first or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, and then, you know, I mean, this is weird for me this year because it's first year. I won't have worked in a record store on that day, and it's the first year that I've released records through my label.
Yeah, which you should tell us about, because before we switched on the mics, before we had this chat, you were telling us about that and how you're sort of juggling that. Maybe you can tell us a bit about your label and the thing that you're putting out for Records Store Day.
So I started a label called Death Waltz Recording Company. I'm like a really big soundtrack fan, and it was just something that was going to be a bit of a hobby, and it's kind of grown into something, you know, a lot bigger. And, you know, we release soundtracks on vinyl with all new artwork, posters, prints, like really fancy coloured vinyl, like tricolours and splatters. And I kind of wanted to do something for Record Store Day, but I couldn't think what would be really cool. So I managed to license a bunch of old 60s TV themes. So like Star Trek, Lost in Space, The Munsters, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And we've done I've done really crazy like glitter, black vinyl with like glitter in there and stuff. So
this is
you
the
can
sort
really
of stuff.
Run with
this
stuff,
is amazing.
You know?
Yeah, this is really nice. Yeah. And what sort of runs are these?
There are 1,000.
Right. Okay.
Worldwide. Okay. So it's not a lot.
Well, don't go away, Spencer, because our special music theme will continue for a little longer. But first, we're going to get a taste of some of these local businesses. We set off around the world to visit some of the stores participating in Record Store Day. First stop, we're talking metal in Sydney.
Our customers range from the very small young school kids right up to their great grandparents. It's not unusual to have three generations of the one family, grandpa, dad, and the son, come into the shop and spend a couple of hours just looking through. You come down that entrance, which is dark, you walk down the stairs, and then you open it up, and the first thing you're going to see on either side of you is a whole bunch of frame memorabilia from all your hard rock and metal, anyone from Alice Cooper to Metallica to Lamb of God to Bullet for My Valentine. And I want you to know
I took it with me. Bestsellers are like Nick Cave, James Blake, The Knife, which I like personally very much. We are right in the middle of Berlin. My name is Sven and I run the Lila M record store. So I sell vinyl and CDs, but yeah, two-thirds is vinyl, one-third I would say is CD.
My name's Mark Collins. I work in a shop called Tidal here in Adelaide, in Australia. The taxman's taken all my dough. We sell quite a bit of jazz and soul on vinyl, but definitely new releases would be number one. We also sell quite a lot of classics on vinyl that have been remastered, you know, bands like The Stones and The Beatles and The Kinks, and lots of classic albums from the 70s by bands like Television and Neil Young and Fleetwood Mac. Record stores almost seem to be an endangered species these days. You know, we've got a lot of regulars that are really excited and passionate about the day because there's a lot of limited releases that come out on the day, and there are a lot of, you know, albums by current and former artists and new stuff as well that comes out on vinyl by older artists, and there might only be, you know, 300 or 1,000 copies, you know, worldwide, so they don't go too far. You know, you have to be pretty lucky to get some of the releases that come out on record store day.
I'm Josh Maydell. I'm the co-owner of Other Music. We're a record store in the East Village in Manhattan.
I pulled a couple of our big sellers. This first one is a group called Bona Dish, and this just came out on Capture Tracks, and it's a reissue of a very obscure British post-punk band, early 80s. They put out two cassettes, basically, in the early 80s, and it's, you know, experimental post-punk that is really brilliant. Unsung band. That was our number one seller last week. Also, a local Brooklyn artist named Charles Bradley, his second album just came out. We're a store that's all about our taste and our passion, and we are try to stay one step ahead of the trends and just like turn people on to new music. And at least in New York, I think there is still a lot of people who love buying records.
We've been in business 35 years, and a lot of our customers have been with us for 20 plus years. Having said that, we're seeing a lot of younger people come through or starting to come through for the vinyl, for merchandise, and we also try to put on events that will attract the younger crowd, like in-store signings. We are actually seeing younger people come into the store more and more. It's just great to see people who come in and are there to enjoy the fact that they're surrounded by physical product, and then they're not just on a computer screen browsing through a million different photographs. You can actually touch it and feel it, and that tactile experience is, you know, you can reconnect with it.
I mean, when you listen to vinyl, it's a different way of listening to music. Besides that, you're usually listening to it on a stereo with real speakers, and you're sitting in front of it, and you have to flip it over halfway through. I mean, it's a higher quality and more intimate listening experience.
People get reminded of the small independent shops, and they can get in touch with that, or with them, and can feel the spirit of independent shops. Last year it was really amazing. A lot of people came, and I got good feedback. So I'm very hopeful for this Saturday. You see that black boy over there running
scared, his old man in a bottom. In days gone by, record stores were the only place pretty much that you could buy music. And a lot of the artists today, artists that they revered and respected and drawn a lot of influence from in their current music, most of those artists, you know, would have been heard, apart from on radio, for the first time by lots of people in record stores. So it's good that, although there's not as many left as there used to be, perhaps that fact means that the few that are still around are really sort of treasured by people that love them. Time after time after time, people in a bottle.
So a little flavour there of some of the record stores around the world that are participating in Record Store Day this Saturday. And in that little mix you just heard, Gary Stapleton, who owns Utopia Records in Sydney. They've been in business since 1978, specialising in hard rock and metal. Sven Stout from Layla M Records in Berlin Mitte. Josh Medell, owner of New York's legendary Other Music. And Mark Collins, co-owner and manager of Tidal Records in Adelaide's East End. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Spencer Hickman from Record Store Day is still with me here in the studio because it's time for more music geekery. After this,
the Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where I have one last question for our guest today, Spencer Hickman, because we're moving from the topic of records now to gig posters. Limited edition handmade prints are becoming an increasingly familiar sight on the merchandise stalls at gigs in the UK and around the world. It's a DIY but blossoming industry, and it's something we're going to explore today here on The Culture Show. Spencer, do you think the poster revival is part of the vinyl and record shop revival?
I think people have been told for so long that the future is digital, everything's going to be on your portable device, that I think actually now people are like, no, we actually want stuff. It's what makes us, and it's what kind of what defines you. When I go to a friend's house, first thing I do is look at their walls, look in their record collection, and just mooch about to see what stuff they have.
While they're making the drinks, you're doing a bit of Columbo.
Yeah. So I think there is that move, and you know, I also think people like, say, for instance, a gig poster, and a band like Pearl Jam, they do a poster for every single show, so every single town. But what they do is they get a local artist from that town to do it. So I think people go to that show, and years ago it used to be that you'd get a T-shirt, and that, you know, that would be your remembrance of the show. But now you can buy, like, a really awesome silkscreen signed poster, frame it, put it on your wall, and you always remember it. Yeah. So, you know, I think just generally there's a move towards physical because people realise that actually that is worth something.
Thanks, Spencer. And this world of the gig poster is something that producer Katie was keen to find out more about. So she hops south the river on London's Ginger Line, that's the Overground, to have a cup of tea with one artist who's been a central player in the UK's burgeoning scene.
I try as much as possible to produce work that is a visual representation of that band's sound. I would hope there's a decent amount of difference between the artwork I would produce for the Melvins compared to the artwork I would produce for Django Django, for instance. That said, I'm sure there are kind of elements within there that are reflected throughout my practice and throughout other kind of posters.
Luke Drodds is sitting in his cosy top-floor studio cum art gallery cum flat in Peckham, South London. On one wall sit hundreds of vinyl records, many of them valuable library music. It's the kind of thing only true music fanatics appreciate. On the opposite wall, his books are organised by their coloured spines.
There obviously is an ilk of person who is drawn to this. People who are predominantly passionate about music and passionate about art and passionate about making artwork, I guess, that is accessible and direct and available to the general public, I suppose. Yeah, weirdos.
Luke's a visual artist. He makes sculptures and does various bits of commercial illustration work. But today, we're talking about his other line of employment. Luke is head of the UK Poster Association, an organisation set up to support and promote gig poster artists in the UK and overseas, including himself.
So I've done three posters for Black Keys now. With them being a two-piece band, I've always kind of tried to keep two elements within every poster. So the first one was these two sort of steer running down the side of a hill. The second one was a man having his mind eaten by a bug. And this one is a minstrel knight. Yeah, I sort of imagine him playing beautiful love songs into a volcano, maybe. Things will come out of drawing and sketching which seem to make sense at the time, but when you're trying to explain it to people, either into a microphone or an artist's talk, it's sometimes very difficult to remember why you drew a man having his mind eaten by a bug.
Luke's showing me some of the hand-pulled, screen-printed posters he's designed for various bands that he loves. They come in runs of anything from 50 to 250, each of them numbered and signed. Turn up at a band's gig, and you can pick one up for around £25.
The time and effort and love that goes into these is sort of immense, considering how affordable they are, but I would rather these things be affordable and know that they are hanging in people's houses and being loved than pricing them or making work which is incredibly expensive and that most people will never get to see or experience and that just, I don't know, sits hidden away somewhere. That's what seems a bit sad.
It started as an underground movement, but gig poster art is a growing industry.
And there's a huge scene in the UK matching that of America now.
Crispin Parry is founder of British Underground, a company that promotes British music around the world. Earlier this year, he hosted a discussion at South by Southwest, which has its own poster art exhibition called Flatstock, about the emergence of gig posters.
My discussion was about how that scene that is a very American scene, the poster art scene, is coming out into the UK, Europe, Brazil, Japan. These places are seeing that resurgence happen too.
For Crispin, the posters are a way of establishing a relationship between a band and their fans through a physical object in an increasingly digital world.
Artwork has got smaller and smaller and smaller, and in fact now doesn't exist. And this is a physical representation. It's slightly more expensive than an album to buy, but you can put this on your wall and have an interaction with your band, and you can look at that and have that as part of your relationship with the band, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
It's a sentiment that Luke shares.
Having something which is limited edition, having something which has a tactile quality the way screen printing does, something which is an actual physical object in a world where, I guess, increasingly things are being digitised, seems quite important. how do you offer kind of fans of music who increasingly perhaps don't have a physical thing to hold or a physical thing to remember events or music by? Maybe these then act as an alternative to having physical records or to having other objects from bands. So these are the kind of modern equivalent, I guess, or our kind of tribute to that.
Heard your voice in my head too soon. Pants feel safe. In our cocoon, don't baby, make up your mind.
I'm making things that I would want to collect because I am one of those sort of strange, geeky collector people.
Maybe that's a lesson learned, yeah.
The return to hand-printed styles isn't something that's just having a renaissance in the world of the gig poster. Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, explains.
Certainly, there's been a movement over the last 5, possibly even 10 years, of what's been termed in the industry as handcrafted. I think it's there for several reasons. It could be the forces of the economic downturn. It could be that we just got so used to slick, finished products that we actually just wanted to do something a little bit more organic. 5 years ago, the Parisian creative agency MM, their work for Calvin Klein, it looked nothing like what you'd expect to be done for a luxury brand like Calvin Klein. So it's kind of quite far flung now, this trend.
And whether this change is linked to gig posters or not, the simultaneous evolution of both industries speaks of a wider cultural shift. As a travelling ambassador for British poster art, Luke has seen firsthand how this industry is beginning to flourish around the world.
I guess the exciting things for me are always seeing how a country or a continent that I'm not massively aware of in terms of artistically, how they then deal with the same set of criteria, but for their own bands, or how they then respond to the bands that we're working with when they go and visit their countries. Like whether or not there is culturally big differences between how artists work or whether or not there's an international language within this art form.
And do you think there is?
I don't know. I'm hoping there's a lot less kind of skulls and hot rods and girls than there used to be when it was mainly US-centric. So there's kind of a series of layered drawings on the top here for various bands. So these are kind of some of the original artwork for recent jobs. So this is the...
So who are some of the artists to watch?
Jay Ryan has always been a massive influence on me and my work. There's Landland, who are based over in the US as well, who make like really exquisite, really beautifully illustrated work. Son and Zimmer again in the US, and their work is just sort of beautifully bonkers. In the UK, I mean, Drew Millward, who I first started doing it with, is still making brilliant work. Graham Pilling is another member of the UKPA board who makes stunning work. Telegram, We Three Club, Petting Zoo Prints. Damien Tran, who is a French artist now based in Berlin. There's a guy called Talkseek, I think he is, who's a Polish guy who's making absolutely beautiful and weird things over there.
It's hard to estimate how many artists are working in the UK or globally because of the DIY nature of this scene. But the UK Poster Association represents around 45 artists, although Luke is confident that many more exist. And while it's not really business and profit focused, it still seems to be driven by an entrepreneurial, self-starting spirit. The reward?
I did a poster for Swans for their date at Coco last year and sort of stood back and watched people buying it and seeing people who obviously are really in love with that band then connect with the piece of artwork that you've made for them, that it fits into their vocabulary and the way they feel about that band's music as well, is amazing. When that happens and you see that people are enjoying it and it's selling well, it sort of means that you've done the job right, I suppose. There's no better feeling than that.
Your life is in my hand. Your life.
These really are small and intricate, creative works of art. They're beautiful hand-printed objects, which can find a place in a person's life beyond the event for which they were initially made. So while we may have seen the glory days of album artwork pass us by, there still seems to be a healthy relationship between music and artists. Or, as Luke calls them, people who are good at colouring in. For Monocle, in London, I'm Katie Bilboa.
And Katie brought some of Luke's work back to Midori House, and I can confirm that these really are little beauties. In fact, I nicked half of them off her. So, go to some gigs and get your hands on some. And to see more of Luke's work, just visit lukedrozd.com. Still to come in part two, we'll hear about the new formats and co-productions that were touted at the 50th anniversary MIP TV conference in Cannes. We'll indulge in a spot of Turkish cinema at the Istanbul Film Festival, and we'll hear some more of the tracks being released for Record Store Day. A cultural smorgasbord indeed. Ja, bitte. All right, time for another track to celebrate Record Store Day. This is Bobby Rush. It's going to be on CD and 12-inch vinyl on Soul Selector Records from a new compilation called The Southern King of Funk Blues. This is Chickenheads. Without your love, I just can't go on. But this feeling I have for you is much too strong. So doggone strong. And that's such a lovely record. That was Bobby Rush, and that's Chickenheads from a new compilation, The Southern King of Funk Blues, which kind of does exactly what it says on the tin. There was certainly a bit of Mississippi mud in there. And we'll have one more song from the Record Store Day collection at the end of the show. This is Culture with me, Robert Bounders. As much as we'd like to spin yarns about Record Store all day, it's time to move on. The iconic international TV market, MIP TV, celebrated its 50th anniversary in Cannes last week, hosting 11,000 delegates from over 100 countries. It's still one of the major events on the TV calendar, where people from across the industry go to strike deals, announce commissions, explore new tech, and maybe enjoy the odd cocktail or two on a sun-drenched terrace too. Well, one person who was busy networking down on France's south coast was Peter White, senior international reporter for Broadcast magazine, and he stopped by at Midori House, fresh from the plane from Nice, to tell me about this year's event.
It was quiet, but to put that into context, it's strange to say a market where there are over 10,000 people is ever quiet. The main reason for that is the Americans don't come to MIP TV, so the studios, the Disneys and the Sonys and the such, they don't really come and promote their shows. So what you get left with, which is actually then quite interesting, is you get a lot of interesting shows from other places, whether it's Europe or whether it's Latin America or Asia. So you do sort of see another side of it during April's market.
So when the Americans aren't there playing with their big budgets and their big name kind of casts and series and stuff, yeah. I guess it gives some of the smaller territories a chance to shine.
Right? It does. We were trying to sort of pinpoint which markets were hot. Now, funnily enough, the market is in France, but that doesn't always mean that people are that interested in French shows. However, there was a sort of example of quite a few interesting French dramas being made, and equally Israel remains as hot as a country can be of that size of television market. Everyone looking for the next Prisoners of War, which was the show that ultimately turned into Homeland.
Yeah.
So there was a few there. Yellow Peppers was one that kept being mentioned as the follow-up, a gritty drama, and another one called Pillars of Smoke, which is already apparently being set up in the States with NBC.
There are a few things that we flagged up to talk about, some of the things that we thought might be interesting. One of them is Vicious, mm-hmm. which is a new, in the UK, ITV comedy kind of sitcom.
Yep.
Maybe you can tell us a bit about that.
Yeah,
what happens to that at Cannes?
A working title of Vicious Old Queens, although right. I'm not sure they'd like me to say that. It stars Derek Jacobi and Ian McKellen as a pair of vicious old queens, written by an interesting chap called Gary Giannetti, whose credits come from Will and Grace and Family Guy, so quite a sort of strange background. But the ITV announced over the week that they were going to show a special at Christmas on Christmas Day, which was fascinating. That they're taking the plunge and they're really giving it a hit. And ITV was talking about it there, but also the international. They were trying to rack up some international sales for it. So yeah, it's from what I've seen and. Just a short clip. They did show the whole show at MIP, but I didn't have the chance to see the whole of it. It looked quite funny.
So who were you squawking at on the phone just now?
What? My mother, if you must know.
Was she calling to tell you when she'd be dying?
She was very distraught.
Right, did you finally tell her about us?
I'm waiting for the right time.
It's been 48 years.
And there has not been a right time. Please don't pressure me. I'm very emotional already.
Two obviously heavyweight actors there doing something that's sort of, I mean, especially if it's transmitting on Christmas Day, quite a kind of aloof, I guess, thing, especially for ITV, normally very traditional.
It's quite controversial.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about Hemlock Grove. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a great... It's a great title.
Yeah.
This is a Netflix thing.
Yeah, so this is, and we did a big session down there with Eli Roth, who is the director of it, and he comes from a horror movie background. Yeah. He does these torture porn films like Hostel and Cabin Fever. And he'd been talking about doing TV for a while, but because he's a sort of such a gory auteur, he never really had the chance to make something on traditional television. I think he thought he'd get cut and wouldn't be allowed to show exactly what he wants. So he went to Netflix, and he had this idea. It's based on a book by a guy called Brian McGreevy, and it's from what they showed us, and they showed us quite a bit. It's eyeballs popping out, it's bones breaking, it's people being bitten to death. It's pretty gross in parts, and that's what he's going for. And it's quite edgy, and he described it in a great way. If you were 14 when you saw Twilight, and you're now 21, this is what I want the next step to be.
I'm convinced this was the premeditated act of a pathological sexual predator.
And we should talk about the producer and the platform as well, Netflix. I guess their big hit this year has been House of Cards. It was exclusive to that sort of, well, now it was simply a way of renting movies. Now it's a channel in its own right and producer in its own right.
Yep. No, and they have got some really exciting shows. So Hemlock is the second project to follow House of Cards, which, although we'll never know the numbers, seems to have been a big success. And certainly the perception is that it has done well for the platform, if only in sort of buzz terms. But they have a whole list of new shows coming up. They have a show called Orange is the New Black, which is from the writer of Weeds, which is a female drama set in a prison. They have another show just in development at the moment called Narcos, which is a tale of drugs in South America, a sort of Colombian drug lord tale. Yeah. So they're doing some interesting and edgy
some
stuff.
Great interiors in that, I'd have thought.
I bet. And all of the producers we talk to are desperate to work with them. They spend good money, they promote these shows well, they know what the audience is. And the terrifying thing for people is they can tell how many people watch the movies that these people make, whether it's the stars, whether it's the producers or writers, because they're data driven. So them making these shows is they obviously know that they're going to do well for their audience.
Broadly speaking, is this the future? The fact that Netflix, they know where and when and how many people in the world, precisely down to the street, where the people and how many people are watching their shows. This presumably kind of makes a mockery of the ratings.
It does, and it is the future, and it's the present. I watched all 13 episodes of House of Cards over a weekend. It is, and I watched it on my television screen. I watched it through a device. I watched it through an Xbox games console onto my television. There was no difference from me switching that on to turning on to ITV or BBC. So this will certainly be the future.
We also ought to talk about Da Vinci. Mm. I think when Lisa Campbell came in at Christmas time, she was talking about this. I've clean forgotten what it is now, of course. But luckily you're here to shine some light on that.
Of course. It's to sum it up, it's the story of a young Leonardo da Vinci. But it's written by David Goyer, who is the man who worked on all of the latest Batman movies. So he wrote Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises. This sort of incredible writer. It's quite dark. And some of the stories about da Vinci and his friends, and apparently he had a real sort of motley crew of mates where he sort of Torquemada and Vlad Dracula are some of his best buddies that he goes out with. But this is a guy who apparently created the first machine gun and the first helicopter. So some of us will know some of the elements of his life, but this is sort of taking that and dramatising that. And it's a very international project. It launches over here on Fox Channel. It's a big co-production with a US cable network called Stars. And BBC Worldwide was out in Cannes, making sure that everyone else in the world will see it. So it's it was a fascinating project.
The other week you're holding us. This is your chance to strike.
Not mine, the Lord's.
This isn't your fight, Leo.
Oh, when's that ever stopped me?
There's more to this than Florence or Rome. This is for everything.
Danger was the appeal for you.
That was Peter White, Senior International Reporter for Broadcast, talking to me there on Culture on Monocle 24, where after this, we're going to be watching some films in Istanbul.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino. And our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where we cross now from La Croisette to the Golden Horn. As Turkey re-emerges as an international powerhouse, Turkish arts have followed suit. The nation's cinema is finding its voice, seemingly lost over the last 30 years as TV dramas quench the country's cultural thirst. This is taking place just in time to explore Turkey's rapid and exciting transformation, as Monocle's Joseph Dana found out at the 32nd Istanbul Film Festival.
Istanbul, the former capital of one of the world's most important empires, is a mix of ambition and change. Near endless construction and a steady stream of new residents from the Turkish heartland give the city a feeling of organized chaos. The 32nd Istanbul Film Festival is in many ways a perfect snapshot of this change. From humble beginnings, the festival has grown into an important destination for national and regional cinema.
When it started in 1982, it was just like not a film festival on its own. It was like a week with six films, but it grew within time with the support of the audience.
Aziza Ten is the director of the Istanbul Film Festival. We met in the Para Cafe as the British director Mike Figgs concluded a masterclass for a room full of Turkish film students.
I always repeat that it's been a school for a generation of filmmakers. They really learned the world cinema, what cinema is, through the festival. Because when the festival started, it was right after the military coup d'etat, and it was really the only place where people could come and see the films and meet the directors and know what the cinema was, really. This generation now became very, very successful as directors, and now they are making the festival big and important, and that's something that we are really proud of.
Like Turkey's geopolitical power, the country's cinema is re-emerging onto the world stage. Once a powerhouse, Turkish cinema declined with the advent of private television channels and the nation's television dramas that have themselves become major soft power exports. But now films are making a comeback, taking their place beside their former broadcast rivals as the face of Turkey abroad. But the country's new global identity is as much a confrontation with the past as it is a break from it. And these tensions are visible in the works themselves and on the street, especially in Istanbul. For Sebne Vitriol, the lines between country life and city life remain vague in Turkey. She's the executive producer of Onur Ulo's new film, Thou Gilt'st the Even, which premiered to rave reviews at the festival.
There isn't so much of a city life or citizen in Turkey. It's kind of a new concept for us. For example, Istanbul is a huge city, but comparing to London, it's not exactly a big city in the same sense. In the sense of daily life, daily habits, people's behaviors and social interactions, it's not too different than the countryside. It's the same sort of love, same sort of friendship, same sort of family relations.
But urban lives are evolving in Turkey. Asli Özge is a director that captures some of these tensions. Her first film, Meetings on the Bridge, explored life in Istanbul's poor neighborhoods. It was immediately praised by critics the world over. Her sophomore effort, Lifelong, which premiered at the Istanbul Film Festival, explores a different side of the city, the art world.
most of the trend was actually always about men who are working on countryside, going to different parts of Turkey and showing the great nature. So it was like in a lot of tendency in this way. But I like to tell stories from the place that I was born, which is Istanbul. So it's, that's why I was stuck in Istanbul, and I thought, why not doing a film about people who have problems like my problems.
As if written into a Turkish screenplay, this year's festival was marked by protest. The historic Amek Theater, once the home of the festival, has recently been sold to private investors, keen on developing a shopping mall in the center of the city. Film directors, actors, and even critics stage increasingly violent protests throughout the week. Yael Messer is the co-director of the Istanbul Biennale and chaired the panel, Am I Not a Citizen? Barbarism, Civic Awakening, and the City. She sees an important collaboration unfolding between the art and film community in Turkey.
I actually saw some people that I know from the art world, you know, coming for Louis Buñuel, and people that are usually, you know, more in the artistic scene coming to the film. And hopefully people now that are more engaging in the film festival, now more acquaintance with what the Biennale is engaged with, and they will hopefully come to the Biennale itself. So that's kind of the relationship that we were aiming for.
One could say that Turkey's film community could not have chosen a better time to mature into its own. Recapturing its former glory and prestige, the Turkish film world demonstrated at the Istanbul Film Festival that it's ready to confront the difficult issues facing Turkey today, whether in dark cinemas or on the streets in front of the Amek Theater in the heart of Istanbul. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be asking when a gallery isn't a gallery. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher got tough when the tough got going. Time for one final song this week. It's our last track to celebrate Record Store Day. And as Jack White's the spokesman for this year's day, let's have some White Stripes. Their 2003 album, Elephant, turns 10 this year, and there's a special new edition out for Record Store Day. From it, this is I Wanna Be the Boy to Warm Your Mother's Heart, and pretty damn wonderful it is too. Thanks for tuning in. If ever a girl needs someone to hold, I just hope I don't act.